Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we want to make sure you don't miss the excitement of America's best small town race. Of course, I'm talking about the 21st anniversary of the Fargo Marathon. It's the race that brings that sweet Midwestern charm for a celebration of running on May 30th and 31st. And there's really nothing small about it. And we'll visit with Dr. Andrew Moen from Essentia Health. They're one of the race's key sponsors here in just a moment.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music that we hear each and every Wednesday here on Main Street. It tells us it's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome back to Main Street.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. We have a special guest in the studio today to talk about coffee, one of my favorite subjects.
Yes, Dexter Dutton is with us, and we'll have Rick visit with him more here in just a minute. But I wanted to give you my coffee progression. When I was young, my parents drank coffee, and I loved the smell of coffee in our house. I loved it, but I always hated, I thought, the taste. So fast forward to years later, many years later, maybe just 4 or 5 years ago, and I never had anything to order at Starbucks. So I had to figure something out. So I started ordering a mocha when my wife and I would go. And now I drink an Americano. That's my coffee drink of choice. Is that kind of a standard progression here for us coffee novices?
Oh, I love to hear that peer pressure works. That's great. Welcome to the cause of supporting international trade here. You know, you're supporting farmers around the world. Way to go.
Rick, let's give Dex a more formal introduction, and I'll let you handle that.
Dex is a multifaceted talent when it comes to foodways and just being kind of a popular guy around town. And he's been into coffee for quite a while now and was co-owner of Thunder Coffee in West Fargo. And they have a location in Brujala, which is really a neat location there. But he's also done some international traveling, sampled coffee beans from around the world. He goes to international coffee expos. He knows how to sample coffee the right way. He knows grinds, brews. He's a coffee roaster. He also works for Folkways, which helps put on the Red River Markets at Broadway Square. There's one coming up in West Fargo. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But then he also runs a food stall called Beefcakes ND sometimes and makes these Oklahoma-style smash burgers. And so maybe we'll touch on that a little later on. So, yeah, Dex, welcome. It's good to have you here to talk about coffee. And you brought a little bit of coffee to sample.
Yeah, I did. Well, thank you, Craig and Rick, for having me on. I'm really excited to talk about it. Yeah, and I brought some coffee from Rwanda. I've been really lucky in the past 2 years to have traveled to 4 coffee-producing countries, and one of those was Rwanda. And the coffee that we're drinking today was actually grown in Nungwe Park, where I was able to stay a couple of nights and visit the National Forest there. Beautiful country and really great coffee, too.
And I think Burundi has good coffee as well, and that's just to the south. And I think we have some mutual friends possibly from that country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you spent some time in Vietnam. Talk a little bit about how they make coffee Vietnamese style.
Yeah. So the predominant coffee that's produced in Vietnam, they're the second largest coffee producing country in the world, only behind Brazil.
And that surprises me, by the way, Dex.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
They have so much agricultural weight behind coffee production, and a lot of that is conifera or Robusta coffee, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with Arabica versus Robusta coffee. There's kind of the two main species of coffee that are in common usage throughout the world.
Talk about that a little bit, like maybe some flavor differences or roasting differences, brewing differences. What do you see there?
Yeah, so conifera or Robusta, those are the same thing. They usually grow at lower altitudes, which is great for a lot of the growing regions in Vietnam. It's very low to the ground, very easy to harvest. It produces a lot of cherries per plant, so it's a high yield crop. Where Arabica does a lot better at higher elevations, usually grows on a taller tree and has a smaller yield, but it produces a more vibrant, more acidic, and brighter tasting coffee than the conifera. The conifera is really dark, earthy, chocolatey, but we're seeing kind of a shift in the industry of only focusing on Arabica to this kind of specialty Robusta push due to concerns about climate change and the elevation of where those coffees are grown and how those climates are changing, and as well as better practices at the processing level in countries like Vietnam, where they can get higher quality coffees to roasting countries.
That's really interesting to know, especially for people that are conscious about, you know, consumers that are conscious about buying coffee, because it is an issue. You do hear it out there. So is there any roasting differences? You've done a lot of coffee roasting, like with length, temperature, that sort of thing in those beans?
You know, the differences in roasting between conifera and Arabica tend to be focused on the end product, right? Roasting is a goal to get to the good tasting coffee in the cup. And with conifera, you're working with a smaller range of good outcomes. So you're really focused maybe more on roast level and achieving like a light, a medium, dark kind of singular note. Where with Arabica, there's a wider range of flavor possibilities. And so there's a lot more room to play with development time, or, you know, how long it is in the roaster, or how long it spends before it coffee goes through a crack. It's called first crack, where all the pressure inside bursts and kind of breaks open the seed itself, and you can kind of hear it popping like popcorn in the roaster.
What are your favorite brewing methods? I mean, you see people doing pour over coffee, you see French press, which I really like, and just numerous other things these days. I mean, it's almost like a ritual making morning coffee. If you could discuss that a little bit.
My morning ritual for brewing coffee is on my Kalita 155. It's a small flat-bottomed brewer. Takes a paper filter. I like paper filters when I brew my coffee because it grabs a little bit more of the oil from the seed itself, and that produces a little bit cleaner of a cup. And I only drink about 150 grams of coffee at a time, or at least I try to, because otherwise I'd be drinking a lot of coffee in a day, because I usually drink three cups, I think, you know, brew three coffees in a day.
This is a pour-over style of making coffee. Is it not? I'm looking at what a Kalita Wave 155 glass coffee dripper is.
Yep.
And that's what it looks like to me.
Yep, yep. So you pour the water over the grounds, and through the gravity being worked through there, it's pulling the good tasting things out of the ground coffee and extracting them into your cup.
Is there a special rate of pouring that's important?
There is, but it's really more playing with your ratios of coffee to water. So a good place to start when brewing coffee is 1 gram of coffee and 16 grams of water. So you heard me say that I only drink 150 grams of coffee at a time. So I put 150 grams of water over 10 grams of coffee.
So you measure...
This water is boiling?
Just off boiling, yeah.
Do you measure this stuff out?
I do, yeah.
Wow.
My coffee shrine, you could call it, has my Baratza Encore grinder. I've got a food scale there, and I've got my Kalita Wave with a vacuum chamber for my coffee.
I told you, Craig, he was pro level, man.
This looks like an interesting way to really enjoy making a single cup of coffee. You're not wasting anything, it appears to me. Mm-hmm. You're brewing just what you need, and you can kind of take a moment, enjoy making your coffee, then enjoy the coffee, and what a nice pace I think it would be to start a day this way.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite parts of my morning. I wake up and I set my grinder and start brewing my coffee, and then go sit and write for a little bit before starting my day while I enjoy my coffee.
Let me ask you this question if I could. And we've all seen that, hey, coffee is really good for you. Hey, coffee is not so good for you. What do you think about the issue of coffee and health? I'm sure you've thought about it.
Oh, I think about it often, and I am by no means a health professional, but there are a lot of studies that are showing that there are a lot of forms of cancer that coffee can be helpful in preventing. We know that correlation is not causation, but consuming up to, I think it's 5 cups a day can help prevent diabetes. I think there's 3 different kinds of cancer as well as Alzheimer's.
What kind of coffee are you putting in your Kalita Wave every day? Do you kind of mix and match? Do you have like, this is Monday's coffee and hey, this is Friday's coffee?
Well, I've really been enjoying roasting at home lately. And so I actually purchased this green coffee from Rwanda, saw it online and really jumped at the opportunity to roast that. But I also love supporting, there are some really great roasters in the United States that, you know, I really look up to. Black and White Coffee, as well as Daylily in South Dakota there. They're really amazing roasters, so love supporting them.
So iced coffee, but cold brew versus hot brew. And what are the differences there? What should people keep in mind, especially when doing cold brew, because you don't want that bitter taste?
Yeah. That's a really interesting phenomenon in brewing coffee, is when you brew coffee hot, as it cools, quinic acid forms. And so that is where when you drink a cold cup of hot coffee, that's why it becomes more sour. When you brew it cold, it doesn't have that opportunity to form the quinic acid, which is in tonic water, if you've ever had that. You know, it's that sharp kind of zing that's there. That's why we perceive cold brew to be a little bit less acidic.
And then another brewing technique, I like a French press. And I like that ritual, and it does take some time. I just like French press coffee. It's really good with a pastry or a piece of fruit or whatever you're having in the morning, even just with regular breakfast. But I think there are better, and I know this, but for listeners out there, there are better beans, and you need a coarser grind for that. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're brewing on a French press, that's what we call immersion brewing. So that's actually how I brewed our coffee today, is in a French press.
Oh.
And when you're making an immersion brew, you're basically steeping it like tea, right? You're letting the water sit with the coffee. There's no act of gravity extracting through, what's the phrase? Electrolysis is the act of water pulling out the chemicals in the coffee bean. And when it's an immersion brew, there's not as much motion, there's not as much turbulence, and it takes more time and more coffee to get the same extraction of the good tasting compounds that are in the seed into the cup of coffee. So that's why you need to use more time when you're brewing in a French press. You need to use a coarser grind, and you also usually have to add some turbulence, whether that's stirring or breaking the puck that forms on top before you pour it into your cup.
See, the stirring part, that's a good tip, and I understand why the coarse grind, but I didn't know about the stirring part, so I'm gonna try that next time. You know, with these brewing methods, different beans, different grinds, different roasting, is there a proper way to, in a formal process, taste coffee? And I don't want to be too elitist about it, but I just wanted to discuss that a little bit just so folks know there is a process there.
Yeah, absolutely. From the professional side, there is a standardized way of tasting coffee, and that's called cupping. There are organizations like the Coffee Quality Institute. They are an international organization aimed at speaking the same language about coffee at an international scale when we talk about quality. And one of the tools that we use is cupping in that. A couple years ago, I was fortunate enough to go get my Coffee Quality Institute Q Grader certification, which just means I got to drink a lot of coffee that week and learn how to talk about it really well. But we kind of talk about coffee around mouthfeel or body, the weight of the coffee. The level of its acidity is really important, because although we think some coffees may taste sweeter, a lot of that has to do with its acidity and how we're perceiving acidity. You know, you think about why some of the foods that you really like are really good, and most of the time it's high acidity is a really good thing. We as humans love high acidity things like kombucha or wine or beer even. And then we also talk about how that coffee lasts in its taste. So really good coffee has a long finish. You can think about how that coffee is going to taste for a while. It's not a very quick, immediate sip and gone kind of taste. It lingers, and it's very pleasant.
Boy, this has been a fun episode, Craig. I'm really enjoying this conversation.
I've got a question. I've got two questions, I think, for Dex. One, Dex, is so I brew coffee individually, almost kind of like you do. I use my Keurig. I got a reusable Keurig device, filter, whatever you want to call it. I couldn't wrap my head around using the plastic cups all the time and then throwing them away. So I bought a reusable one. So then I put coffee in it, and then it kind of pours over, right? And then it makes my cup of coffee. One, are you judging me now? Two, can you tell me how I should store the coffee that I'm not using? What I do is I have a small container that's kind of airtight that I put right above my coffee maker. Then the rest of it is stored in the refrigerator. Is that right, wrong?
Yeah, you're onto something great there. So firstly, oxygen is the enemy of most things that taste good, right? So the less oxygen contact you can have with your coffee or as you're storing it, you know, the better. That's why vacuum chamber storage solutions are really popular. Oxidation makes things taste worse. You're onto something really great keeping it in the fridge as well, because as we cool down coffee, it oxidizes slower as well. So as long as it's, again, in a sealed container, not being exposed to the circulation that's in your fridge, then that's great. If you're working through your coffee in about 2 weeks, though, I would maybe skip the fridge step, just because the condensation going back and forth may result in, you know, moisture getting into your coffee that wouldn't already be there. But if you're storing coffee for a long term, and I would say, you know, three to six months after its roast date, that's when I would say keep it in the fridge or freezer.
What is your favorite go-to? You only get one. You only get one cup of coffee now for the next week, but what are you going to drink?
If I could drink one cup of coffee today for the rest of the week, it would be, truthfully, coffee from Rwanda. Before I visited there, it was my favorite coffee-producing region for a couple of reasons, one of which is the high acidity and the high malic acid content in the coffee. Malic acid is what we associate with apples, so it's really bright, crisp, and has some really effervescent qualities that are kind of like this sounds really funny to say, it tastes like a Dr. Pepper in many ways. It's got that cola, it's got that high acidity, it's really delightful to me.
We've got to ask Dex, the worst cup of coffee you've ever had was?
Oh gosh, I believe that all coffee is good coffee. I'm a firm believer in that. I would say
even gas station coffee. Are you sure?
Even gas station coffee hits sometimes. You know, sometimes you're just on a road trip. It's 3 a.m. and you just need something to get you to that next stop.
Yeah,
some of that coffee that's been sitting on the burner all night. You know, sometimes it tastes good too.
It's kind of like when you're out camping, everything tastes good when you really want to taste it.
Oh yeah, yep.
What about tariffs and coffee? Is this something you're concerned about?
I would say that tariffs are a concern for coffee roasters, coffee consumers. We've been kind of living in a golden era of coffee consumption in the United States that I don't know if we'll ever return to. You know, a lot of the buying practices have been inequitable for a long time, and I think the supply chain issues that happened through COVID really highlighted some of that. And now with raising tariffs, I don't know if you saw that Vietnam, I think, is at a 97%. I forget the exact stat of what their tariff rate is going to be on, but as the second largest producer of coffee in the world, that's going to have implications not only on your specialty roasters, but also your Folgers, your Keurigs. That's going to have implications across the supply chain.
Well, let's switch gears now to some of the other many things that you take part of in the Fargo-Moorhead community here. Dex works for Folkways, which puts on the Red River markets throughout the year. And talk a little bit about an upcoming market.
Yeah, we've got a market coming up in West Fargo at Palmia Plaza on the 17th of May. It's a Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. happening on Cheyenne Street there. We'll have local vendors, live music, and all-around good vibes.
And a lot of food vendors at these markets, Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of delicious food. You know, Audubon, really, really great. One of my favorites is Audubon for sure.
Sifa's cool, and Saigon Cuisine is another one that I really enjoy too. So upcoming this summer, when are these markets going to start? And I don't know if you have an exact date yet, but it's usually a Saturday beginning of July or something like that. But what are you looking at there? Kind of the same schedule this year? Is that and I always look forward to not only the food vendors, but there are a lot of produce vendors too. I mean, there's like a block of produce vendors. So
yeah,
I mean, it's so fun to get outside and just look around, isn't it?
It is.
Mm. Yes. So the Red River Market season kicks off, the full season kicks off on July 12th. That is our opening day. It's our 11th season. We're really excited to bring back all of the produce vendors, all of the great food vendors, as well as a large schedule of live performances. And then the Red River Market is just one of the programs that we really champion at Folkways. We've also got a full summer of night bazaars, which is kind of our night market carnival kind of event. Those are so fun if you haven't been to those. Dress up. The next one is on June 26th. That's going to be Renaissance themed.
So there are a lot of food vendors at night bazaar too, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, walk around, grab a beer from Drecker, grab a couple of things to eat, and then enjoy the show.
And if it's a Renaissance theme, maybe we see some big turkey legs.
Oh, I hope so.
Dex, another thing you do is a food stall called Beefcakes ND, and you drive around an old Ford van called with a license plate Beef Wagon, and now people are going to be looking for you, but following you around. But you usually set up once or twice, maybe three times a summer. Any chance this summer? I do like making a visit, so that's why I'm inquiring.
Oh, yes. You know, I am very lucky to have a lot of people that love my Oki-style smash burgers. It was something that came out of a COVID obsession, was making burgers at home, and my friends would not let me stop. So we'll keep your eyes posted. Follow Beefcakes on Instagram, and we'll see where I pop up this summer.
And what's an Oki-style smash burger?
It comes from Oklahoma. Thin sliced onions smashed into the top, flipped over to caramelize, and then topped with American cheese. That is the move.
Dex, on that note, it's been good talking with you about a variety of subjects today, and thank you for your insights on coffee. I think the listeners out there will really enjoy your tips.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Really appreciate the time, and really excited about the opportunity to talk coffee with you.
From a true Q grader, I learned what that was today. Dex, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Craig.
Support for Bray Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people, because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
Main Street continues today with the Fargo Marathon. It's the 21st anniversary of the Essentia Health Fargo Marathon this summer. It's held May 30th and 31st, and it's really nothing about a small town marathon. This is a real thing with live bands, townwide cheering, marathons, half marathons, 10Ks, 5Ks, even virtual runs. And with me to discuss is Dr. Andrew Moen with Essentia Health. He works in Detroit Lakes and he's a podiatrist. Welcome to Main Street and thank you for taking time to visit with us today. Tell me about your running journey. You ran at NDSU back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day, I've slowly realize that I'm one of the old guys now. So yeah, I, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I did compete in cross country, track and field, all the stuff for NDSU. It was great. Had a great experience. Got into running in high school, just like a lot of kids. I was the short, skinny kid that could run. And, you know, when you don't weigh 100 pounds, football doesn't work out. So I was the cross country guy and had some success in high school and college. And yeah, it's been a great journey.
You told me off mic that you are training for triathlons, but I'm curious, in the running portion, what do you think about when you run these long distances? What goes through your mind?
Yeah, so everyone is different. I kind of just blank out and just set her on cruise control and go for a run. I'm not a music guy. I'm not a headphones guy. So I just kind of go out and cruise. That's the way it's always been. But yeah, everybody has their different styles. Some people are treadmill people. Some people are gravel country guys. And some people just bang the streets of Fargo. So I've kind of done it all. But right now, it's when I'm training, it's just head out on the road and go for a run.
One thing that really surprises me about the Fargo Marathon, when you consider how many people participate and how cold it is in winters, which means training time for the Fargo Marathon, right? Man, how do people do it?
Yeah, so I think everybody's, again, does their own thing. There's a lot of treadmill warriors, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with the treadmill. Climate control, TV, running, that works great. I have a treadmill in my basement, treadmill at the gym. But back in the day, I was one of the outdoor warriors too. So we would bundle up and get out there and cruise the streets. So we see people out all winter putting the miles in. I think a lot of times in this climate, we all trend towards a little bit of cross training, hop on the bike, hop on the pool. We're all used to the cold weather up here. It's not too big of a deal.
From a runner's perspective, what makes the Fargo Marathon course, I guess, unique? As a layman, I'm not a runner. I'll admit it. I swim, but I don't run. But it's a flat course. That has to be, I guess, a positive.
Yeah. When you're racing, especially marathon racing, hills and elevation change is definitely a challenge. So Fargo is one of the flattest, if not the flattest, higher end marathons in the country. If I'm not incorrect, I believe people travel from fair distances trying to hit their marks, trying to qualify for various things like Boston Marathon or any of those events that have time standards. So Fargo is definitely a flat, fast course, as long as the wind and the rain and those other conditions cooperate.
How would you describe Fargo's race culture?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we already talked about me being an old guy. I remember when the Fargo Marathon started. That marathon day one, I was running at NDSU. And I'd say at that time, we didn't really have a running culture in town. I think everyone thought we were crazy. All these skinny dudes out running in the middle of winter. And there wasn't many others out there with us. When the marathon started, it was pretty small. But it was a really cool vision that Mark Knutson had when that thing got rolling. And it grew and grew and grew to a pretty amazing event. We've been in the Detroit Lakes area now for about 15 years with my wife and boys. And we brought the kids up for the little kiddo run when they were 2 years old and 5 years old and those kind of things. And then we've kind of bopped around and done a bunch of the events since we've been back in the area. I've done 10Ks, half marathons up there, and the growth of the running scene in town is tremendous. We have some specialty running stores in Fargo that weren't there, and just the growth of the whole scene and the presence, and even the surrounding communities seem like the races have grown and grown and grown with the Fargo Marathon.
For someone who's new to running their very first marathon, especially here in Fargo, what advice would you give them? The internet is packed full of advice for folks who are running their first marathon with training programs predefined and everything is just there, but blow all that away and give us the good advice.
Yeah, probably the best advice, as you already hit on it, is to pick a training program. The science behind building a program is really there for both injury prevention, but also maximum performance. When I started kind of getting back into running, I just, I'm a professional. I know what I'm doing. I'll just, you know, go out and and it usually ended up with me getting hurt or me burning myself out or something. And then as I got a little bit more serious into doing different things, I started prescribing to some of these training programs. Back a few years, you'd go buy a book or you'd get the Runner's World magazine and there'd be a 14-week training program. Now it's so high tech. You can have an online coach. I've hired coaches for some of my training things. You can almost get these AI-based programs, but really any training program that has some validation through any reputable Runner's World. There's different companies called Training Peaks is an online program that I've used in the past. Following a training program is probably the most intelligent way to go about training for a marathon. If you're a super high-end guy or a new, an entry-level runner, the program and following the program and sticking to the paces really is beneficial both for performance as well as injury prevention. So,
how important is cross training? You talked about that earlier. Yeah. To me, it's just a way, A, to break up monotony, but maybe B, not to overstress certain parts of your body.
Again, that's a super individual thing. Some people have perfect mechanics that they don't get injured. It doesn't bother them. And they do great. Other people that are a little bit more injury prone probably would benefit from some cross training, work a little bit of that adjuvant muscle groups and just give whatever body part to a break. Some of us have old injuries that we have to nurse along as we train. So cross training is really, really important for some of us.
So when you were running at NDSU, and I'm guessing you did weigh more than 100 pounds, but did you find yourself in the weight room?
Yeah, that was really probably the transition. In the 70s, nobody lifted weights. Nobody did anything. Probably late 90s, early 2000, we really started doing a lot of weights. Pretty routine stuff, nothing super fancy. But now researching what even the high level guys are doing, the professionals, all the way down to the amateurs, a lot of that resistance training, strength training, hip core, all of those things are really, 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 really important. I found that getting on the exercise bands, even some really heavy lifting, is a benefit, especially for some of our old muscles.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Andrew Moen. He's a podiatrist from Detroit Lakes, and we're talking about the Essentia Health Fargo Marathon that is in town May 30th and May 31st. There's events from virtual runs to 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons and marathons. There's really almost something for everyone. Dr. Moen, I'm wondering whether you as a podiatrist probably maybe see the most type of injuries of any practice for people who are training maybe too much or have certain injuries because of overuse. Is that accurate?
It's probably up there. A lot of times with marathon training, as we just talked about with the training programs and things, trying to be intelligent as we build up. And so a marathon probably isn't something that we should say, let's hop in the Fargo Marathon next week. A plan over 3, 4, or 5 months is probably the best way. And then work up slowly. And when I see patients for a lot of conditions, overuse injuries, specifically like a tendonitis or a stress fracture, metatarsal stress fractures, long bones in the foot, are very popular with marathon runners. But anybody that comes in with a stress fracture, I say, typically this is something that we see in marathon runners as you're building up for a marathon program, just because it's so frequent. The body has to adapt from whatever baseline level of activity to preparing to run 26.2 miles. And if it's a completely foreign activity, the stress on the muscles and on the bones of the feet and the lower extremities really take a pounding. So the body can adapt, but we have to do it in an intelligent way. So yeah, long answer to I see lots of overuse injuries as people prepare for Fargo Marathon and other marathons in the summer.
I told you off mic, I have a family member who's training for the Fargo Marathon. He's not run a marathon. He's going to run a half marathon. But here we go. One of these injuries, and we're 40 days out, and he's just so sad about it, wondering now if this is going to prevent him from being able to do it. Are you able to help folks who have these types of injuries in training make it on race day, or is it something like, no, you got to wait till next year?
So this is tricky. So there's different injuries, if you can get far enough in your training and build up enough endurance, there's a lot of ways that we can limp our way through these events. There are certain injuries that are high risk where we say, okay, if it's a stress fracture, say the navicular bone in the foot is a very high risk bone, where if you have a stress fracture there, I'd say, oh man, we should shut her down. This could be a thing that can be life changing if we get a bad fracture here. But there's some fractures, metatarsal stress fractures, you can run on them without that. It hurts. You have probably a month to run on them before they get really, really bad. But if you do it in an intelligent way and assess the risk, there's ways to push through some of these injuries when you have a goal in mind. Now, when you complete the marathon, it's going to hurt and it's going to be sore for a while. And then there is a recovery. You can't cheat recovery ever. You can delay your recovery. But as we stratify the risk of some of these stress injuries, there are ways to get through the marathon, especially when we're, a month out. So we're getting close.
Let's get in your wheelhouse here. Let's talk shoes and training gear. You mentioned earlier that technology is our friend, I'm guessing. What should people think about when they're thinking about socks, when they're thinking about shoes, when they're thinking about gear to run? We don't know yet, of course, what the weather is going to be.
Yeah, from a shoe perspective, the technology has come a long, 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 long way. And shoes are always updating. Everybody's built a little bit different. And I really think that there's a shoe that matches everybody's foot somewhere. And you just have to spend a couple $1,000 to figure out which brand or which style is yours. And it's, unfortunately, it's a kind of a trial and error. We like to say like these maximum support shoes are best for the pronators, and these high arch people should go into a cushioned shoe. And that's true for the most part, but there's some nuance to it. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is trial and error. Going to the shoe store, putting the shoe on, jogging on the treadmill a little bit, and trying to match that shoe to your foot, but also to your running style. There's some super minimalist shoes that certain people do very, very well with minimalists. Those guys are patient or runners that have very little biomechanical faults, that straight legs, skinny, good flexibility. And then some other people that have more knock knees or bow legs or super flat feet, if they try the minimalist shoes, they're going to get hurt. And so trying to really match that shoe to your running style is a bit of a trick. There's, like we talked earlier, there's running specific stores in Fargo. Shields is always great.
What about socks? What should we be looking for there?
Yeah, the sock stuff, I mean, again, technology is great. Back in the day, we all ran in those old nasty cotton socks. Any of these new era Lycra, whatever that material is, they're all great. I like to have a little bit of compression, just a little bit of a tighter sock. It feels good on some old Achilles tendons and things like that. But I think any new era running sock, we used to get in trouble wearing those old nasty cotton socks, but I don't know that those exist anymore, maybe. So,
from what I know about running, I'm supposed to eat a lot of spaghetti the night before. I don't know if that's an old wives' tale. I'm guessing it is. But what's the biggest mistake that you find or that do you hear about that runners or those who compete make when it comes to these high endurance activities?
Yeah, perfect. That's a super great question. And that's been so I was out running for quite a while when I was doing medical training and raising little kids and things. And so when I came back, I was using my old school mentality. We used to have things called carbo loading, and you eat a whole bunch of pasta the night before. There is something to that. Most recommendations now is just be normal. Carbohydrates are great. Simple sugars are great. We run on simple sugars. And so the trend has been more from the carbo loading, meaning a pre-race giant meal, to in-race nutrition. And so that's taken me a little bit of a trick. And so in the last month, that's what people can really, really focus on, is developing that in-race nutrition. So the easiest way in marathon is to utilize those gels. Any type of activity that lasts longer than an hour burns up our primary fuel source, the glucose and the glycogen in the muscles. We won't get into too much of a nerd talk here, but I think any race that's longer than an hour, we should probably be doing some in-race nutrition. And the gels are the probably the right way to go. I used to make fun of a lot of the gel stuff 20 years ago when I first started out, and now I was wrong. It's super important. So we say 30 grams of sugar of nutrition. You in a gel, those packets are usually 30 to 40 milli- or 30 to 40 grams, and then do it every half an hour. Start earlier rather than later. But that's something that needs to be practiced. So our marathoners or half marathoners are going to be building up on their long runs and their training programs right now in the next week or two. And so really practicing that in run, in race fueling is super important. The elites right now are pushing the maximum of how much their bellies can handle. That's the drawback, right? So you put stuff in the belly, and then we all hear those super exciting marathon stories of emergency sprints to the outhouse or thrown up on the side of the road and those adventures. But the high-end guys are saying they're trying to get as much fuel in during the early part of the race that they can handle without having a GI problems.
I was watching the Masters, and I found it striking that Rory McIlroy, when he was in between walking 17 and 18 and then after 18 prior to having his playoff, I couldn't believe how much it appeared that he was drinking. And I'm not sure what he was drinking, but he was drinking something. And that was interesting to me, but it brings the question of hydration. How do people handle that either pre-race, night before, and during race?
Yeah, so this is another science thing. So again, old school is water, water, water. Now we know that too much water can actually cause a little bit of trouble. So we try to balance with some electrolyte drinks. And so when you think about sweat, that's a lot of fluid, but a lot of electrolyte. So he probably had an electrolyte drink, but there's probably some sugar in that too, because walking the Masters, they're burning energy. And you'll see a lot of times old school guys are drinking, you know, eating candy bars or whatever, drinking sodas. So in these endurance events, really working on our hydration with some electrolyte. There's tons of electrolyte mixes out there that people can research. And again, this is something that needs to be practiced. See what your belly can handle. But before the race, during the race, some electrolyte mix is pretty good. The tricky part about marathoning is that we rely on aid stations, and usually it's a Gatorade or a Powerade or water. Sometimes you can't pick the thing that you like. I can't tolerate Gatorades, and Powerades are kind of goofy and sweet for me, so they upset my stomach, so I have to stay away from that. But you can carry those gel packs, and a lot of times the gel mixed with water will give you some electrolytes as well as that fuel.
Dr. Moen, we have about a minute left. Tell me what the most important thing and is a must-do recommendation for runners in the first 24 to 48 hours after they finish the marathon. Besides drink beer, maybe?
Yeah, have a burger and drink some beer probably is the best answer. So I think it's give yourself a break and chill and relax. And the big effort is done, and don't really, there's not a whole lot that you can do. Go for a walk or a light jog the next day, but give your body and mind a break.
Enjoy yourself and tell yourself congratulations for a job well done, perhaps, too.
For sure. For sure. For sure.
My guest today has been Dr. Andrew Moen with Essentia Health. He works in Detroit Lakes, and he's a podiatrist. We've been talking about the upcoming 21st annual Essentia Health Fargo Marathon that's May 30th and 31st in Fargo. There's something for everyone, from a virtual race, a 5K, a 10K, a half marathon, and even a full marathon. And of course, there's plenty of room for volunteers as well, and you can go to fargomarathon.com to learn more. Dr. Moen, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on Main Street.
All right, thanks. It's been fun.
Support for PrayPublic is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. That kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 23rd. In April of 1904, Wahpeton had four newspapers, each with its own political slant. At the time, J.A. Rickert was a prominent figure in Richland County. He'd served as county commissioner, county treasurer, county sheriff, and president of the Board of Education. Rickert owned a significant amount of property and was known for his success in both farming and business, including a mercantile store in Lidgerwood. His home in Wahpeton and the other, a modern farmhouse near Lidgerwood, were featured in county plat maps and land brochures. His wife and children were well-liked, frequently mentioned in church, school, and community news. As with many public figures, Rickert occasionally came under fire in the press. One such incident was described as a peculiar case when a complaint was filed against him for discharging a firearm within city limits. A warrant was issued, but enforcement was relaxed. Wahpeton's chief of police served the warrant in Lidgerwood, then allowed Rickert to finish planting before he asked him to return at his convenience. Nothing more was reported until late May, when Rickert appeared before the county insanity board. After testimony from over 20 witnesses, he was released. No further action followed. 7 years earlier, Rickert had retired as sheriff. Gunfire in town wasn't unusual when he first arrived in Dakota Territory in 1875. In 1896, Rickert was sent to arrest a man named Trimble in Walcott who had shot and killed Mr. Hagen. Trimble was angry that Hagen had committed his wife and children to the county poorhouse. The Wahpeton Times reported that the entire town, young and old, chased Trimble with rifles, revolvers, and pitchforks. He was shot by the village blacksmith, but Rickert managed to rescue him from the mob and take him to jail. Trimble told Rickert he would not have run had he known the sheriff was coming. Though he survived his wound, he was found dead in his cell on January 22, 1897, one day before the trial. He was buried at the county poor farm. J.A. Rickert died in 1919. His farmhouse was moved next to the Wahpeton family home for the funeral. As of today, both homes still stand on lots once owned by Rickert. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, ready, set, fly, but in a drone. Drone racing is more than a thrill. It's launching Midwest students into futures as pilots, engineers, and innovators. We'll talk about the regional drone racing tournament that lands at NDSU this May, where speed meets STEM and the sky's no longer the limit. Plus, Matt Olean will review a movie he really likes, The Ballad of Wallace Island. And Dave Thompson and I will review the news. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.